Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Visiting Lethbridge in February is an unusual experience, especially for a northerner like me. Driving south from the land of ice and snow, it's hard to grasp a landscape that just melts before your eyes. A Chinook has just passed through, and all around there's nothing but brown grass as far as the eye can see. While this might foretell another dry summer in Alberta, you just can't beat wearing shirt sleeves outside in February. No wonder scientists are lured to the University of Lethbridge to teach and conduct their research. Scientists like Michael Gherkin, who practices extreme chemistry. There's Hester Jiskut, who chases galloping glaciers. And Sean Bubel, who's digging up a newly found buffalo pound. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. You've heard of extreme sports and all the thrills involved. Well, how about extreme chemistry? That's the way Dr. Michael Gherkin refers to his research at the University of Lethbridge. His chemical of choice is fluorine. And a day in the lab means dressing up in leather togs, safety helmets, arms swaddled in neoprene, all the time wondering if the compounds he's working with will blow up.
So fluorine is my specialty, basically, and fluorine is the most reactive element in the periodic table, so that makes it very interesting. The special property of fluorine is that it can form very stable compounds. For example, Teflon is very stable, and very reactive compounds, which hydrolyze readily. Like if you throw them in water, they will decompose immediately, or they're so reactive if they get in contact with organic materials, you will get a fire, basically. So, and then the handling of the very reactive elements, compounds, that's the special interest of mine, to use those elements, to those compounds, to prepare new compounds. Yeah, and just basically investigate how far I can push chemistry and the reactivity of these compounds.
You were just showing me around your labs, and you've got some pretty specialized equipment, because one of the hoods that you're using, you can't even allow anything to come out into the air. Could you describe that for me?
Yeah, I have a walk-in hood, so a very large fume hood. And inside that walk-in hood, I built a stainless steel nickel vacuum line system. In this system, basically, we move all the water and the oxygen and all the air from the inside so that I can fill it with fluorine or with other very reactive materials. And so I basically exclude moisture and oxygen from everything that I'm doing. And I want to contain all these reactive materials inside the fume hood and basically inside that vacuum line. Otherwise, would be almost like a hazard to our health, to my health and my students' health, and I don't really want to harm anybody. I want to really do safe chemistry with very reactive compounds. That's the primary goal.
What's the importance or significance of fluorine in the chemistry that we do today?
Well, fluorine occurs basically in all fields of chemistry and in our daily life. I mentioned already Teflon, so in fluoroplastics. Fluoroplastics are high-performance polymers, high-performance materials. It's also in membranes for fuel cells, for example. So if you think about environmental technology, fluorine compounds are also used in those fields. In the semiconductor industry, CLF3, chlorine trifluoride, or nitrogen trifluoride, very reactive compounds are used in the semiconductor industry. Also fluorine is present in drugs, in pharmaceutical compounds. I think 20% of all pharmaceutical active compounds contain fluorine. And that's very significant.
Where does it come from?
Oh, the fluorine. fluorine is found as calcium fluoride. you know, basically the preparation of elemental fluorine involves an electrolysis of a melt. So quite a sophisticated way of preparing an element. There are only a few companies in the world that, that prepare fluorine, elemental fluorine. Air Products is one in the States. There's one in South Africa, a few in Europe, a few in Japan. So not every company can make fluorine. So you have to have a very sophisticated setup for that.
Now, you've said what you want to do is push the limits of chemistry. How are you doing that with fluorine?
Because fluorine is the most reactive element in the periodic table. I can make compounds with fluorine that are not possible to make with other elements. For example, chlorine. Chlorine is a very quite reactive element too, but it's not as reactive. So sometimes we look at what is called oxidation states. So we want to achieve the highest oxidation states possible. We can only do that only if we have a very electronegative element, very reactive element like fluorine. And if we have if we use elements like chlorine or bromine, then we don't reach these extreme states, like these extreme oxidation states. And therefore, that's in that respect, it's pushing the limits, basically.
Have you come up with any new compounds yet?
I'm here in Lethbridge for 1.5 years. And recently we actually prepared a new compound, an iodine compound. Iodine in the center and then two oxygen atoms around and three fluorine atoms around. So basically the IO2F3 2 minus anion. Sounds quite esoteric, but the compounds that I make are structurally very simple. So basically you have one central element and elements surrounding that central element. So not like organic compounds where you have large compounds, chains of carbon atoms. And just looking at these structurally simple compounds to find out what kind of geometry they will adopt is very interesting, and that's what I'm interested in, to see what geometry they have.
What would that tell us? Like, why do we have to know the geometry of the atoms and the molecules?
We want to know how to predict the structure and bonding in compounds. There's an easy way. That's the VSEPR model, valence shell electron pair repulsion model, taught in high school and, of course, in first-year chemistry classes. And that was developed by Gillespie, Ron Gillespie. He's actually a Canadian from McMaster University in Hamilton. And he's still doing research, still publishing. When he looked at a couple of compounds, or his colleagues looked at a couple of compounds, they found out that the VSEPR model, VSEPR model, does not predict all the geometries accurately. So there are exceptions. And we want to find these exceptions, and we want to explain why they are exceptions, why they behave differently. And increasing the number of different structural types is very important to increase our knowledge about structure and bonding.
You're still setting up your lab, and you're expecting to get a special kind of spectrometer in. What will that do?
Yeah, I expect to get a Raman spectrometer probably within the next month. This is a spectrometer that I will use for routine reaction control. So basically I have my sample, stick it into the Raman spectrometer and just record the spectrum. And I will see if I prepared a new compound because I see new signals, or if I just got the old compounds and nothing had happened. So I basically use it as first as a reaction control, and then if I prepared a new compound, I will use that as a characterization technique to really unambiguously characterize that that new molecule. It's quite difficult to explain the theory behind Raman spectroscopy, but basically I'm looking at vibrations. So a molecule can stretch and contract, or two bonds can bend, and those are vibrations that I will observe in Raman spectroscopy.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks.
That was Dr. Michael Gherkin, assistant professor in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at the University of Lethbridge. Hester Jiskut was only 13 years old the first time she saw a glacier in the famous Alps of Europe. But it was then the glacier bug took hold, and today Hester is a scientist researching how glaciers are formed and how they move. This summer, she will conduct her fieldwork on glaciers and their tributaries in the Yukon. But on the day that I met Hester, I couldn't help but wonder how she could possibly study glaciers from Lethbridge. Even in mid-February, a Chinook had cleared away what few drifts of snow might have been there, and the coulees outside Hester's window were barren and brown.
I started studying glaciers in Holland, so that's even further away from any glaciers. So the funny thing is that the coulees, even though they're dry now, the shape is actually formed by the glaciers during the Ice Age. There were big outburst floods, and they actually formed these coulees. So it is actually a really close connection to the glaciers here. There's a lot of different ways in which you can study glaciers. You don't necessarily have to go out and do field work on them. There's a lot of data already collected by other people, so I can do data analysis on that. I can look at satellite images, air photos, other data just from my office. So the bulk of the work I can do here behind my desk, looking at sunny Lethbridge in February.
What are some of the things that you found out so far in your research about glaciers?
I found out that glaciers are very complicated. My PhD research that I did in England focused on how glaciers flow and why they are unstable sometimes. Some glaciers flow really fast, other glaciers flow really slow, and some glaciers flow sometimes fast and sometimes slow. And I tried to find out why that is and why that doesn't happen in all the regions. And I did a lot of statistical data analysis, and I actually found out that it is very complicated, and there's a lot of factors that determine why glaciers behave the way they behave. And one of these things is the type of climate that they're in. Another thing is the geology. So what is the rock type that's under the glacier? Another type is the glacier has different shapes. Like some glaciers flow like a big dome. They flow in all directions, and other glaciers flow just down a mountain, just one direction, and they have really different behavior.
What's the importance of glaciers to us on an everyday basis?
What you can see here, still in the winter, you have a lot of water in the Altman River. So first of all, what we see here in the prairies, the base flow in all the rivers actually comes from the melt of the glaciers. So that is important for, you know, agriculture and all the water that people use. In the big climate system, it's very important because glaciers act as sort of thermometers. If the weather gets warmer or the climate gets warmer, then glaciers recede, they become smaller. And that is a very big change, so it's easy to measure. Another thing is that if a glacier gets bigger, you can drill a hole in the glacier and get the ice core out, and you can actually measure all the layers of all the snowfall year after year. So it's a climate indicator. And then thirdly, that the glaciers actually shape the landscape. They erode and they push material forwards. And actually here out in southern Alberta, the top 10 to 20 meters is moraine material that is basically material that was plastered by the ice sheets.
You're going to be doing some work in the Yukon, dealing with flows. You had mentioned that before. What will you be looking at there?
I'm particularly looking at small glaciers that flow into the big glaciers. And if these small glaciers flow into them with enough speed, they can maybe block part of that big glacier. So they slow that big glacier down. So what I'm looking at is I will go in the field, measure the flow speed of the big glacier where the small tributary glacier is coming in. And I will measure the flow speed and look what that small glacier does to the temperature of the glacier, to the water that is inside the glacier, to the whole structure of the glacier. And I'm trying to derive how the glaciers that flow together, how they exactly interact.
Now, why would you go to the Yukon and not do it here, say, between Jasper and Banff?
A lot of the glaciers between Jasper and Banff have receded a lot during the last 50 to 100 years, and their flow is not very active. So they have like slowed down a little bit. So that's one of the reasons the glaciers in the Yukon are more active, so it's kind of easier to measure that interaction. The other reason is that because of the type of mountains where the glaciers are in, here in the southern Rockies, the glaciers don't have as many side arms. So I can't actually find a proper glacier with a tributary, so with a small glacier that actually flows into the big one. Whereas in the Yukon Territory, you have a lot of those types of glaciers.
Why would they be more active there? Does it have to do with climate warming?
No, those glaciers haven't really become more active due to climate warming. It is true that a lot of the snowfall here in the eastern Rockies has diminished, so there's less snow that's falling and the summer temperatures are warming. That is the same process that actually happened in the Yukon Territory. But the glaciers there are bigger to start with. So even though they have melted back a little bit, they're still bigger. So they actually flow a little bit faster. There are also much more glaciers, so I can choose between a lot of different glaciers.
How fast can these glaciers move? Is it something that would have economic significance, for example?
Some glaciers can move. Normal glaciers, like here in the mountains, move on average about 100 meters a year. So they melt back with the same rate, so we don't actually see them move forward because that's the same rate with which they melt off. But some glaciers, for example, in Greenland, they move with speeds up to 18 kilometers a year. So you can actually sit there on your chair and see day by day how fast they're moving. A lot of the glaciers that move really fast, they end in the sea. So how do they melt? They melt by chunks of ice breaking off and just going in the sea as icebergs. And icebergs have some economic significance, partly because they can go into shipping routes or into oil platforms. They can bump into them. But also you can use part of that water as drink water, potentially. The other thing is, if you have a glacier that suddenly starts to move really fast and you have a road close by, then that glacier can override that road and it can destroy everything that's in front of it. And
just in a matter of days?
In a matter of days, yeah. In Alaska, there's a lot of these unstable glaciers that have flowed for 20 or 30 years. They flow at a normal rate up to 100 meters a year, and then suddenly for 1 or 2 or 3 years they speed up. And this happens in an area where there's the Alaska pipeline. So we don't want to build the Alaska pipeline too close to these glaciers, because those glaciers might destroy everything that's in our path.
Why would all of a sudden they just go so fast? It's like at a gallop.
It is. There are some people call them galloping glaciers, yeah. The official term is surging glaciers. We don't really know. There is some internal instability. It might have to do a little bit with how the bed of the glacier is. If you have a very soft bed that, if it's wet, if you have clay and you put a lot of water in the clay and you press it together, you can make it a slurry, right? It can actually deform really fast. That's one of the ways, if a glacier is resting on a soft bed and that bed actually gets saturated with water, then it can sometimes flow really unstable. A glacier, of course, is glacial ice, but most of the movement of the glacier is happening at the bed, and there's often a lot of meltwater at the bed. When that meltwater is under a lot of pressure, it can actually lift up part of that glacier. So the glacier doesn't have as much friction under the bed, and then it can move forward really rapidly. You asked me, why do they suddenly do that? Well, since maybe the early 80s, people have done a lot of research on this topic, and we know a lot more about it now, but we still don't know exactly why.
Thank you very much, Hester.
Okay, you're welcome.
That was Dr. Hester Jiskut, an assistant professor in physical geography and glaciology at the University of Lethbridge. There's more to Tabor than corn. Turns out there's a new archaeological site just waiting to be excavated. And that's the task assigned to Sean Bubel. Sean is an assistant professor of archaeology at the University of Lethbridge. She travels all over the world digging in the dirt, looking for artifacts from ancient civilizations. This summer, she'll have her students digging in their own backyard at site number DLOX5, a buffalo pound that only came to light a couple of years ago.
A buffalo pound is potentially a place that the people would have driven the buffalo into an enclosed area. Now, they could either build a sort of structure where they would drive the buffalo into and then eventually be able to kill them, or it could be a natural structure like a parabolic dune, which is a dune that has an opening and acts as a natural barricade to trap the buffalo in.
So how would that differ from a jump?
A jump is where they actually drove the bison right off of a cliff. So they would organize themselves to actually push the bison to a certain area, and then the bison would fall off the cliff, and then they would be killed if they weren't killed already once they reached the bottom.
Now, you've got something really exciting happening because you're going to be dealing with a new site. Tell me about this site. When was it discovered?
Well, we think it was discovered a couple years ago, but it might have been known to the local community for a while. But this site is what we think is a buffalo pound where they drove the buffalo into one of these dunes that were existing in the area. So they probably drove them from a fairly open landscape and then up and then into this dune, and then had hunters standing around that were able to throw some darts or arrows and then eventually kill the buffalo.
So where is it near?
It's just north of a place called Grassy Lake, which is near Tabor.
And how could it have gone unnoticed for so long?
Well, it's basically in an area that's full of these sand dunes, so it doesn't have a high agricultural use. These areas are mostly used for cattle and for grazing and things, so there aren't a lot of people that are walking out in the fields or just kind of looking at the area. So you don't have the city or the local population getting to the site on a normal condition.
You've spent a little bit of time down there. What have you found so far?
Ooh, lots and lots of bison bone, a lot of artifacts. We have actually a special type of artifact, these projectile points and flakes made out of something called Knife River Flint. It's a very beautiful type of stone. And what's interesting is that it's not local. So because of the high percentages of these pieces of stones that we find, we think that it might be actually a group that's following the buffalo or coming for some reason from the south into our area.
Any idea how old this site might be?
We think it's for sure several thousands of years old, but until we actually do the carbon dating on the bones, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, not too far away is Head Smashed in Buffalo Jump. How far back does that date?
Oh, that dates back to about 5,500 years ago. The first use of the Buffalo Jump at Head Smashed in was about 3,600 BC.
Now that you have this site here and you know that you've got work to do, what plans do you have?
Oh, very exciting plans to start off this summer. What we're doing is I'm organizing an archaeological field school where I actually take students into the field and teach them how to excavate. So I'll probably take 15 students from the university and 20 students from Red Crow Community College, and we'll work together and excavate the site starting in May.
Well, just to go into a bit more detail, once you get down there, what do you do so that you don't destroy everything?
Well, we excavate using a very controlled scientific method. So we don't just dig holes wherever we feel like and find cool artifacts. We actually have a very structured system that we divide the site out into grids, and then we excavate very, very carefully, drawing everything we find, recording the position of everything we find. And then once we get back at camp, washing and labeling all the artifacts and doing the analysis stage. And we're also putting everything into a geographical information system, so a computerized system that we can record basically everything that we're doing at all times and the positions where everything is found.
How does this fit into the rest of the work that you do?
Ooh, Well, I am a field archaeologist, so every chance that I possibly get, I am running off and digging up wherever I can. So this is one of the sites that I will be excavating over the summer. I'll also be taking students with me to excavate at my site in Israel. So I do a number of different excavations, and basically any chance that I can be right there in the ground is good.
Now, why Israel? What's the interest there?
Basically, I mean, there are many sites in the Near East that we look at to try and understand things like, why did we adopt agriculture? Agriculture first started in the area we call the Fertile Crescent, which includes Israel, Jordan, Iraq, Afghanistan. These areas were where civilization potentially started. So there's all sorts of wonderful things that can be discovered in these areas in addition to agriculture. So we're going to be going to Israel to excavate a site that our area that we're excavating dates to about 1200 BC. So it's right at the turn of events in the Near East in Israel at that time. So it's very exciting to investigate that as well.
So it'll be kind of neat for you, too, to be able to make the comparison between the two, what's happening in the Middle East and what's happening here as you make the dig in this new buffalo pound.
Yeah, it's actually very fun because these sites are very, very different, as you can imagine. And we use very different excavation techniques at both. The site that's near Tabor, the local site, will use very high detailed techniques to record basically everything we find. And so the students will be learning how to use sieves for every single thing that they do and how to draw every single bone that they find. And it's very, very detailed compared to the Near East in Israel, where we're digging with large shovels and working through meters and meters of occupation. So it's just a very, very different method and completely different types of artifacts. So it'll be interesting. Those that are going to both sites will definitely have good experience in the extreme ways to excavate an archaeological site. So
thank you very much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
That was Sean Buble, Assistant Professor of Archaeology at the University of Lethbridge. And just a note of caution if you're thinking of doing a little excavation or digging on your own. It is illegal to remove artifacts from this archaeological site. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, the Alberta Research Council, the Capital Region Innovation Centre, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.